From Pacifica Radio, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. I am Malihera Zazan. This week, we bring you the second part of our conversation with anthropologist Sardar Saadi, focusing on the economy of the Kurdish region and the polity of the Kurds in Iran. Later in the program, we'll speak with Laura Kiswani, the executive director of the Arab Resource and Organizing Center, AROC, about the proposed curriculum on ethnic studies for K through 12 students in California. Stay with us. According to Kurdistan Human Rights Network, in a recent wave of arrests, the Iranian regime has detained at least 24 Kurdish citizens since January 8th. Most of those detained are student, environmental, and cultural activists. The persecution of political and civil society activists among the Iranian Kurds has been a prevalent feature of the regime's securitized approach to the Kurdish aspirations and their struggle for self-determination. Today, Iranian Kurdistan, or Rojalat, is the most militarized region in the country. Securitization and militarization of the regime's response to its Kurdish population dates back to the early months of the 1979 Iranian Revolution, when the Kurds revived their decades-long struggle for self-determination and demanded cultural and administrative autonomy for the Kurdish region of Iran. In the first part of the interview, we discuss the trajectory of Kurdish nationalism and the Kurdish demand for autonomy within the democratic and federal political structure of a future Iran. This week, we continue our conversation with Sardar Saadi, focusing on the economy of Rojalat and decades of Kurdish activism in Iran. Sardar Saadi is a PhD candidate in anthropology at the University of Toronto and the host and producer of the Kurdish Edition podcast. He spoke with Shahram Aghamir.
The region's economy was traditionally based on agriculture and animal husbandry in rural areas and commerce in the urban centers, as you point out. In your articles, you cite the limited number of industrial sites and their locations along the outer edge of Kurdish provinces as evidence for long-term policies of de-development in Rojalat by the central state and an economy based on Iran's security and military. Can you talk about those policies and their impact on the population and the labor force in Kurdistan?
Well, in my university years in Iran, I did my first research about the balance of industrial development in Kurdistan, especially in the Kurdistan province, and how the government's, central government's investment in Kurdistan is taking place. And at that time, I found out, by looking at different factors, different parameters, that most of the industrial sites are actually located quite close to the border cities, the border areas of the Kurdistan province, where actually Shia Kurds are living. The population is mainly Kurdish Shia. So in the cities of Qurba and Bijar mainly. And from that time, it was a very important question for me to see how the economy of Kurdistan is taking shape by the ways in which the state invests or proposes development projects in the region. And in many parts of Kurdistan, we see this tremendous number of unemployed young people who have to leave their cities, their villages, to go to different parts of Iran, to the southern parts, to in oil fields, to many brick factories called Kurakhana, brutal places of exploitation of people's labor. In many parts of Iran, central parts of Iran, especially in bazaars, markets for fruits, we can see, like I personally, during the time that I was living in Iran, most of those places where they were selling tarebak, like fruits and vegetables, we know all of those who were working there because they were Kurdish from different cities of Kurdistan. And many construction sites, Kurdish youth were working in different parts of Iran. So we see these de-development policies of the regime in the way that it drives the Kurdish youth to find their sources of livelihood in other parts of Iran. So in Iran, in general, we cannot talk about this advanced level of industrialization, and except for the oil industry, in other areas, these industries are kind of very much located in the central provinces. But in Kurdistan, especially with the securitization and militarization of the region, it was basically, I think, even speaking in economic terms, in business terms, it was a risk for any sort of investment in that region while a political unrest was taking place, was ongoing. The development had some reasons behind it, as I said, this political situation of Kurdistan, but also some very intentional politics of the regime by driving out the Kurdish youth from that region and taking them to other parts of Iran, and not giving the Kurds these sources of livelihood in their own places of living, their own villages, their own cities. By mid-2000s, we see that a new economy, which is a border market, rising in Kurdistan, that of course we can talk about that, and how this is kind of taking a toll on the Kurdish youth, that they're basically trying to survive.
Tell us about this trade at the border between the Kurdish region in Iran and the one in Iraq. Who is benefiting from it, and how is it further marginalizing the poor, as you mentioned in your article? And there is this feature about it, a new form of labor called kolbari, or being a porter. Explain to us how this whole thing was set up and what it entails.
Well, the proximity of some of the cities of Rojava to Iraqi Kurdistan, to Bashur, traditionally it was like a market for smuggled goods that are coming from Iraq to Iran, or from Iran going back to Iraq. And it was taking place. It was not a phenomenon that happened in the last decade or so. There was some sort of qachaq or smuggling business at border market before. But since, we can say, mid-2000s, there was an expanding market for smuggled goods and for this border market to flourish. There are many reasons behind that. Some of them could be the early stages of sanctions against Iran, where people trying to get many goods from outside of Iran, and this border market, not just in Kurdistan, but also in other parts of Iran and even in the Gulf. This smuggling business was one way for Iranians to find goods and to sell them in other parts of the country. But in Kurdistan, I think this border market was more about bringing in those goods that are kind of illegal. So alcohol, cigarettes, and some other goods that are not allowed in Iran because it might basically challenge the Iranian manufacturing system. And also a lot of cosmetics that were also not produced in Iran and were not brought in because of Islamic issues. And these markets, as I said, in mid-2000s, expanded every part of this border region, both with Turkey and within Iraq. We see this explosion of different centers, different city malls, like shopping places, where these goods were sold to both the Kurds and also to the people who were taking them to the central parts of Iran, to Tehran, let's say. And the main work of this market was done by a group of people, a big group of people, mainly youth, that were called kolber. And kolber is basically is a porter, someone who is carrying these goods along this borders of Iran and Iraq, and this mountainous terrain taking them from some locations in the border sides of Iraq to some villages or cities in the Iranian side.
To be clear, this is a treacherous terrain. You're in a mountainous region, the temperatures could be quite brutal, it could be very cold, snow, and then on top of it, they have to carry these heavy loads on their back.
Also, a lot of minefields left from the Iran-Iraq war, and as you said, this terrain could be very, very dangerous for all of those youth, many of them like 16, 17 years old. The statistics that are coming are just so frightening, how many teenagers are trying to make some money because of this border market, using this border market. The main problem, the main obstacle for coal bars were not just the minefields, just the mountainous terrain, but the Iranian border guards who regularly would shot and kill these coal bars. And in many parts, the Iranian regime justifying that in terms of the border control and in terms of protection of the integrity of Iran's territory, but this is not the case. And in many parts, there is a corrupt system of control, but just these irregularities in the border. So as I said, this border market provided some opportunities for this youth to find alternative sources of livelihood, while there is nothing in terms of industry, in terms of a market in the region to recruit them. And many of them, they're in very young ages. They don't have experience in these mountainous areas. And as you said, they're carrying these heavy loads of goods and they're being shot by border guards. And as I said, most of the times these border guards, they are doing it intentionally. And while this regime of border control is very much corrupt, and we know there are many news reports that there is some sort of management by the government that does not approve this free way of bringing goods. And if it's not controlled, you have to pay a price for that. And as far as I know, this form of labor called Beri, this border porters, it's not illegal, actually. But border guards randomly shoot at anyone crossing the border without considering the social and economic life and conditions in which these people are in. Many studies have been done about coal bari, and there are some particular human rights groups that are working with coal bars, with these porters. And there are some scholars, for example, there was an article particularly talking about coal bari and talking about the economy of Rosh Halat and this everyday survival situation as apartheid economy.
You were suggesting that there are groups with connections to the centers of power that sort of control these routes for goods to be brought into Iran from Kurdistan in Iraq. And if there are people who are not part of their plans, they get shot at? Is that what's happening?
I think maybe it's not an official policy. It's not something coming from central government, from Tehran. But in the region, there's some sort of a regime of control that oversees this border market. I don't think it is possible that all of those peoples, all of those malls in Kurdistan continue to flourish, continue to sell all of those smuggled goods without some parts of the local government, the people appointed by the regime, some parts of the military apparatus of the regime active in those parts, in those border parts, that are not benefiting from this market. But those who are being exploited, those who are doing the most treacherous and the most difficult part of the work, there are these young men who are carrying goods on their backs. And this is because the lack of opportunities in Kurdistan for these people to find other sources of income. Because there is no control, and there is no attention to what's happening to this Kurdish youth. Many people starting this work in a very, very early ages. We have Kurds who were shot dead and they are 14 years old, 15 years old. We have so many young porters that from this very early ages, they take this very risky business just to provide some food, some livelihood for their families. This is the reality. I don't believe that the government in the cities are not kind of collaborating with some major people who are part of this border market.
Let's talk about today's Rojava, Kurdistan, and in terms of activism there, in terms of political tendencies. You say that during the presidency of Mohammad Khatami, that was from 1997 to 2005, there's another group of actors that sort of emerge in Rojava, a class of educated middle-class men and women, some of whom held administrative ties to the government. They promoted a politics of change regarding the Kurds that was based on reforms and civic engagement with the Iranian government. You can tell us what happened to that strategy. At the same time, almost concurrently by the late 1990s, we see the emergence of a new force in Iranian Kurdistan, Rojava, and that's the influence of PKK. The new protagonist consisted primarily of leftist Kurdish students, activists, and intellectuals inside Iran who were critical of the Kurdish Democratic Party and Komala, the older political parties, now mostly in exile, mostly based in Iraqi Kurdistan. These activists and intellectuals were looking for an alternative. And you say that they were eventually organized into a political party called the Kurdistan Free Life Party. PJAK. This happened in 2004. Tell us about PJAK, its political strategy and its base of support, and perhaps its relationship to PKK. Can you talk about these two tendencies?
Yeah, sure. After the Iranian Revolution in 1979, we see this widespread military security campaign against any elements of Kurdish opposition remaining in Iran, mass arrests, executions, and most of the Kurdish parties and groups and activists, they leave Iran, they go to the mountains, they go to Iraqi Kurdistan, and later resettle in different camps in Bashur, Iraqi Kurdistan, and as you said, many go in exile, and those remaining in Iran, they had to stay quiet, and there was a time that, especially after the assassination of Dr. Abdurrahman Kasımlu in 1988 in Vienna and Austria by the Islamic Republic's assassins, terrorists, we see this kind of silence in Kurdistan, this lack of political activism, social and political life. After that, we see some uprisings in some cities of Kurdistan, in Mahabad. There was an incident with Shwana Qadri, and there was some other incidents in other cities of Kurdistan after the assassination of Qasımlu, and then after the assassination of Dr. Shafkandi, people kind of reacted to these assassinations. There were daily boycott, daily strikes. For example, when I was in Mahabad during those years, people shut down the whole city for a day in protest of these assassinations. So we see some very momentous events in Kurdistan, but there is no mass or a visible political movement in Kurdistan. Until 1999, when the leader of the PKK, Abdullah Öcalan, was abducted on February 15th. And after that, every city in Kurdistan, they started the demonstrations, also in Tehran. I guess there was also one in Tabriz, if I'm not mistaken. People came to the streets. The objective was basically to condemn this abduction. It was about the Kurdish cause in some other country, not Iran. So the regime was also okay with it for the first actions or second ones. But then In Sanandaj, in one of the actions, one of the last actions, the regime committed a massacre and killed tens of protesters. And during that time, I was in Tehran, and we were part of the student movement that was just basically trying to benefit from the relative opening after the coming to power of Mohammad Khatami, as you said. So with Mohammad Khatami and with the reformists in power, there were some openings. And Öcalan's abduction and the protests against that were kind of the basis of a revival in Kurdistan, and a new polity was about to emerge in Kurdistan. Before that, let me just also say that the new Kurdish generations, the new Kurdish intellectuals, the students, that I was also part of that, they were also very much frustrated and disappointed by the main Kurdish opposition parties, by the Kurdistan Democratic Party and the Komala, and their inactivity in Kurdistan and Iran, and lack of any sort of proposal for what they want to do. They were looking for an alternative. So during this reformist opening in Iran and this very major event that affected every Kurd all over the world, the abduction of Öcalan, the alternative basically came up to be the PKK. And many young people, many young students joined the PKK, and the PKK started to mobilize the Kurdish people in Iran around the same political program that they were following at that time, and it was kind of an anti-colonial independent Kurdistan, and as I mentioned at the beginning, a new language, a new terminology, a new politics. And in 2004, we see the rise of the establishment of the Party of Free Life of Kurdistan, Partia Jiyana Kurdistan, Azada Kurdistan, PEJAK, and the PKK becomes an actor in the politics of the Kurdish people in Iran. And many of those who were looking for that alternative joined this movement, this group. For kind of a background, I could say that PEJAK emerged as a need, as an exploration by the Kurdish youth, the new generation of Kurdish youth that went through the Iran-Iraq war, the military campaign of the Iranian regime against the Kurds in Iran, the assassinations of Qasem Lu and Sharaf Kandi, and the years of Kurdish struggle without getting to any end. And they were looking for something that provides them with this paradigm, with this polity that is not just about Iran, but also about all parts of Kurdistan. And the PKK was that political power that united the Kurds in Mahabad, in Sanandaj, Kurdish students in Tehran and Tabriz, to those in Erbil, in Istanbul, in Diyarbakir, and everywhere, all over Kurdistan and the world, actually. Also bringing in diaspora, and as I said, the main and the first Kurdish satellite TV was established by the PKK in Europe in 1995, and it had a huge effect in popularizing the PKK ideology in all parts of Kurdistan.
It seems like there's also another group of activists who are on a different track. They're basically pursuing a more of a reformist strategy still in Kurdistan. Or they are the people who used to pursue a reformist strategy. Maybe they have changed course by now. In other words, you're dealing with PEJAK, who has resorted to armed confrontation in addition to organizing at the local level. But there is another group who is obviously not thinking that armed struggle is necessarily the best way to go about making a change in Iran. So these two tendencies live side by side. They do seem to pursue different strategies.
Yeah, so PEJAK was that alternative for this political opposition against the Iranian regime, but also speaking to the Kurdish identity and unifying the Kurds in all parts of Kurdistan under the same political strategy. So it was one emerging political force in Öcalan. The other one, as you mentioned, during that rule of Mohammad Khatami and reformists in Tehran, many newspapers, many publications started coming out and in Kurdistan, it was also the case. We had many bilingual Kurdish-Farsi publications and different student groups in different universities all over Iran. They had their own publications. We at this university in Tehran, Allame, we had our own publications, our own groups. Every day we had these political discussions with groups, different gatherings, a lot of meetings, and a lot of working with the reformist activists in Tehran. So the reformist in power in Iran, it was kind of revitalizing not only the Kurdish political movement, but also a kind of bringing together Kurds with other activists trying to change this very rigid and conservative Islamic regime in Iran. For example, we worked with many reformist activists in Tehran in different universities to establish different associations, publications, different rallies, a lot of meetings in the university. And it was not just about the Kurdish issue or the Kurdish political rights. It was also about Iran. It was also about the future of this country and making changes. So many Kurdish activists at that time became part of this reformist movement. And many of them, they did not want to be affiliated with the Kurdish political parties, including Peshmerga, and not just the traditional ones. They had also some connections with the government. They were public employees of the state or working in universities, some intellectual and writers and journalists among this group of people came out. They became very influential in the politics of Kurdistan. And as you know, in the sixth assembly of the Iranian parliament, Majlis-e Shishon, there was a very important presence of Kurdish MPs who were supportive of the reformist movement. So we see this emergence, we see the rising of this group of people who belong to the reformist movement in Iran, and they became very influential. But they could not become this political bloc, this power bloc, to make the change that everyone wanted for, because the political system of Iran, as we saw, did not allow this reformist movement to go much further. And also their social and economic basis and their insistence to stay away from Kurdish political parties, all of that, all of these factors were causing this group to not bring the change that people wanted. But they are still there, and they are still very much active, and in many cases the regime tolerates them, but we see a lot of cases of arrests, of people getting punished, persecuted. For example, Mohammad Sadiq Abudman was one of the very important people in this group of Kurdish reformers, who was the president of very well-known Kurdish human rights organization, who was arrested for years, but he's still in Iran. And there are many journalists, many different activists in different areas who are still in Iran, but the regime frequently arrests them, punishes them, and persecutes them. The last example was Zahra Mohammadi, who was basically a Kurdish teacher, trying to teach Kurdish to her students, and she was active in different grassroots organizations, in different NGOs around environmental issues, around poverty, but they arrested her and she has been in jail since 2018.
On that note, Sardar, in your article you refer to a July 2019 report by the United Nations on the situation of human rights in Iran that states that nearly half of Iran's political prisoners are ethnic Kurds, while Kurdish people make up just 10 to 15% of Iran's population. The report states that ethnic Kurds constitute a disproportionately high number of those that receive the death penalty and are executed. This is a quote from the report. We are in 2021 now. What is the current state of human rights in Kurdistan? Why are so many Kurds being targeted by the regime's security and intelligence services and its judiciary?
As you said in this report, there are a lot of different reports, not just international human rights organizations, in this case the United Nations, but also some local groups have some very detailed reports. As we mentioned, the issue with coal bears, there's a website, Coal Bear News, that constantly provides statistics of coal bears being shot, all of these human rights violations in that area in Kurdistan. But it is ongoing. In 2021, and with the state that the Iranian regime is in, and the Kurdish movement for federalism, for self-determination, whatever you name it, it's not so much separated from the 2000s, the 1990s, and the 1980s, to be honest. And I think the Iranian regime is more in fear and in this denial that any sort of responding to the Kurdish grievances of its own people, the Kurdish people, and also other excluded and marginalized people based on their national background or religious background or any other groups that are not part of the identity, ideal group of people that the Islamic Republic wants them. They are being persecuted. There are many cases of executions we have been hearing. And Kurds are, one could say, the most politically active group of people who are still part of an ongoing rebellion against the Islamic Republic of Iran since its establishment. They are very much active in all parts of Kurdistan. They have military groups, they have defense forces, and in terms of mass media, they have many mediums in their hands. And Kurds probably are the main group in Iran who have preserved their oppositional character against this Islamic regime since its establishment. So of course they are afraid of the Kurds. Of course they oppress them, they kill them. Of course they are not hesitant to find an opportunity to basically dismantle and to basically destroy what the Kurds are achieving. Many of these NGOs, grassroots groups that are active in Iran are being shut down. And as you mentioned, and as I said, many activists are being jailed. So this suppression is ongoing. And the government, this Islamic regime, finds the Kurdish people their natural enemy. Especially right now that there are fears that there is an upcoming war between Iran and the Western powers, especially the United States. They always see the Kurds as an element of animosity, if it makes sense. A part of the enemy who tries to invade Iran and dismantle Iran and separate different parts of Iran and disintegrate this country. I think this is an ongoing process, and it is not just about this year or last year or the year before.
In November 2019, there were nationwide protests that were sparked by an increase in fuel prices in Iran. But they went beyond the issue of fuel price and called for social justice and political change inside Iran. How extensive were these protests in cities of Rojalat, the Kurdish region of Iran? And what does that tell us in terms of the future protests or unrest in Kurdistan or Rojalat?
So as you know, in 2009, it was the Green Movement in Iran, and we had some other protests in the years after that the Kurds did not particularly participate. But the 2019 protests, they were kind of different. And after imposing sanctions on Iran, the economic situation tremendously affected. The people of Iran, they paid for that, especially the poor paid for the sanctions in most cases, in most part. And you know that the prices of the essential goods, essential food, skyrocketed. So in terms of economy, people were desperate. People, doesn't matter in Kurdistan or in Tehran or in Khuzestan or any part of Iran, they were all affected. So of course, when the protests started against the rise of fuel prices, all of other issues, the misery that they have been through, in those last few years after the sanctions, they all came up. And the Kurdish people, they saw that this is a common issue, a common pain. It was no longer about, it was not about just about political freedom in a way that it was portrayed by protesters, activists in central parts of Iran, especially in Tehran. The issue was very much about the periphery, those who have been extra marginalized, extra excluded, those who were extremely impoverished, who got nothing from all of those resources that were available for years and years in Iran and established its regime and its military apparatuses and all of its power, that kind of intervening in all parts of the region. People were fed up with that. And it didn't matter if you're Kurdish or Persian or Azeri Turk. I think the issue was common. Of course, they participated and many people died, I think, in these protests in Kurdish cities. So one of the main differences, referring to your question, one of the main changes in this recent protest was that there is a common issue, that people are basically fed up with the system and they want change. And this change must immediately translate into making their life better, bring them out of their misery, their impoverishment. And then probably talking about political freedom, about social freedom, and what kind of future for Iran could be envisioned as part of all of the discussions. But the base is right now very much common between everyone.
Sardar Saadi is a PhD candidate in anthropology at the University of Toronto and the host and producer of the Kurdish Edition podcast. He spoke with Shahram Aghamir. You can read Sardar Saadi's article titled "The New Wave of Politics in the Struggle for Self-Determination in Rojalat" online at Middle East Research and Information Project, MARIP.org. From Pacifica Radio, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. In 2016, former Governor Jerry Brown signed AB 2016, a legislation that required the California Board of Education's Instructional Quality Commission to develop a model curriculum for use in high school ethnic studies courses. And for more than a year, teachers, academics, activists, and community members have been trying to convince the commission to keep the California Ethnic Studies Model curriculum intact, including the proposed Arab American Studies lesson. I spoke with Laura Kiswani, the executive director of the Arab Resource and Organizing Center, about the curriculum and the latest on the state's proposed ethnic studies model.
In 2016, Assembly Bill 2016 passed, which essentially mandated the California Department of Education to develop a curriculum for California schools around ethnic studies, K through 12 schools. And this was coupled with Assembly Bill 331, which would require ethnic studies as a high school requirement for graduation. Since then, the curriculum was developed by a group mostly volunteer writers, ethnic studies practitioners and scholars, named the Ethnic Studies Model Curriculum Advisory Committee. Their work was made public in August of 2019 and available for public comment, and since then has received a very concerted effort to undermine ethnic studies and attack specifically their recommendation and inclusion of Arab American studies within the rubric of Asian American studies. So for the last year or so, we formed a coalition, the Save Arab American Studies Coalition, to protect the fidelity of the discipline of ethnic studies and to also defend and protect the inclusion of Arab American studies, understanding that the attack on Arab American studies was actually essentially an attack on ethnic studies. And so where we are today is after many deliberations and public comments and iterations of Instructional Quality Commission meetings, they were able to extend the deadline for their mandate, which has now extended to March 2021. On November 18th and 19th was the latest IQC meeting where they deliberated on the latest revisions to the ethnic studies model curriculum.
So according to EdSource, the California Department of Education is recommending dozens of wording changes and additional lesson plan about Pacific Islanders, Japanese and Korean Americans, and other ethnic groups to its proposed model of ethnic studies curriculum. The revisions apparently respond to criticisms that the document, which is undergoing its third revision, is, quote, too polemical in presenting racial struggles.
Yeah, so the latest revisions were actually quite interesting and outrageous to us. So since last August, there has been an effort from communities of color, ethnic studies scholars, to challenge this attack on the ethnic studies model curriculum. And since then, the opposition, namely the Jewish Caucus, as well as other pro-Israeli interest groups, have shifted their narrative to make the case that Jewish community members are also communities of color and should be included in ethnic studies. So where we are today is essentially at a point in which Arab American studies has now been relegated to an appendix of the ethnic studies model curriculum, where it was originally included under the rubric of Asian American studies. And in addition to that, a lesson on Jewish American experience and other communities has also been included in that appendix. So what we are seeing is a way in which the Jewish Caucus, pro-Israeli interest groups, and other right-wing attacks, and we must also name this all happened during a time in which Trump passed an executive order against anti-racist curriculum, and at the same time where Governor Gavin Newsom vetoed the bill which would make ethnic studies a requirement for high schools in California. So at this very same time, they are now moving away from an ethnic studies model curriculum to a more multicultural studies curriculum, which many of the writers who originally drafted the curriculum are calling an All Lives Matter curriculum. The latest version does not include a lesson plan that is actually within the around Arab American studies that at all adheres to the fidelity of ethnic studies. In addition to that, the latest version also does not align all lessons within the curriculum to the framework, principles, and values of ethnic studies, a promise that was made to us by the California Department of Education last August.
So when you say it's been relegated to the appendix, what does that exactly mean? How is it going to look like?
That wasn't clear to us, to be honest. So when we saw the revisions that were made public on the public notice for the November IQC meeting, all of us were quite confused about what that meant and how things were organized. And after some meetings and conversations and some inquiry and research, we understood, and especially after the IQC made public comments and deliberations about these revisions, we now understand what has happened is CDE has decided to create what they are calling the bridge, a section called the bridge, a new appendix based on the wording of Superintendent Tony Thurman, which includes communities who do not fall neatly within ethnic studies and some communities who do not fall at all within ethnic studies as a way to demonstrate interconnectedness between them and the core groups of ethnic studies. So essentially splitting and separating out Arab American studies from ethnic studies and relegating it to the appendix and really creating replicating a notion of separate but equal that we're all too far familiar with from both experiences here in the United States as well as our homelands. So this new appendix puts together groups that don't fall within ethnic studies based on the language shared by the California Department of Education and relegates them to a footnote as a way to affirm that they are given a nod, to quote Superintendent Thurmond, and in relationship to the four core groups. And Arab American Studies is considered one of those lesson plans that are relegated to that footnote.
So there is a commission that advises the State Board of Education, which by law must adopt the curriculum framework by March 31st. Schools are not mandated to follow this curriculum, correct?
Correct.
Who serves on this commission?
Well, most interestingly, the newest member to this commission happens to be a board member of APAC, a consultant to Israeli Ministry of Social Work. So the commission is quite diverse, mostly includes educators and those with a background in education, but also includes appointees from the Senate and the Assembly, in which case Anita Friedman, who was the most recent appointee, was appointed by the Senate. So someone like her, for instance, is there to safeguard the interest, right-wing interest, of the Jewish Legislative Caucus in California.
In September, Governor Gavin Newsom vetoed a bill that required ethnic studies for graduation. It was reported that he got a lot of pressure from outside groups. So what was behind that decision?
That was shocking to us, that after Assembly Bill 331 was effectively gutted from its original framework around ethnic studies, and even that was celebrated by Zionist interest groups around the safeguards, as they named them, that were developed and inserted within AB 331 to make sure that their interests were protected, that still Gavin Newsom decided to veto it. What is most interesting about that is that decision was made after the August IQC meeting, where Superintendent Thurmond decided to go public and make an announcement that after erasing Arab American studies from the ethnic studies model curriculum, they had then decided to, in fact, assert and affirm the inclusion of Arab American studies within Asian American studies in the ethnic studies model curriculum, and they will include a lesson in the next revision process. Right after that is when Governor Gavin Newsom vetoed AB 331. Is there a relationship between that? We do not know. Is there some retaliation that the pro-Israeli interest groups took it upon themselves to enact? We do not know. However, it was quite shocking, especially to the ethnic studies community across California, that even after the Jewish Caucus, the JCRC, the ADL celebrated the safeguards that were inputted within AB 331 by the Jewish Caucus to protect Israeli interests, that they then also celebrated the veto of AB 331. Yeah. So we know that Jewish Community Relations Council's directors across the state of California came out in public celebrating and supporting Gavin Newsom's decision. What does that mean? It's unclear to us. Can we make an assumption that there is a direct relationship between the interests of the conservative Jewish caucus and pro-Israeli interest groups? We leave that to the audience to make that logical outcome. However, it is clear to us that the relationship between AB 331 and AB 2016 is quite clear, that the terrain of education has become a priority for those invested in advocating for and protecting the interests of the State of Israel, and to the point at which they are willing to undermine all interests of communities of color across the country in the state of California.
What's in the Arab American study lesson? And how was it put together?
So the Arab American lesson that is now being considered is an Arab American lesson plan that was not vetted by ethnic studies scholars. So the Arab American lesson plan is a lesson that was proposed and submitted as a public comment by a well-meaning graduate student in California who was interested in this topic, felt compelled to take action given the controversy and the attack on Arab American studies. And rather than use the lesson that CDE solicited original writers of the ethnic studies model curriculum for, so I repeat this, and this is an important point, in August, before the August IQC meeting, At the 11th hour, CDE solicited a lesson from the original writers of the curriculum on Arab American studies, asking us to submit them a lesson in order to consider it for the new revision. That lesson was submitted, and it was revised from the original lesson that was part of the ethnic studies model curriculum. They let us know that in order to consider an Arab American lesson plan, revisions had to be made to the original unit, actually, that was included in the ethnic studies model curriculum. So going from a unit to a lesson was in of itself a revision. And so original writers made revisions to that lesson and submitted it to CDE based on their solicitation of that lesson prior to the August meeting. Then we found out from CDE that lesson, there were a few points in that lesson that they named specifically were quote unquote controversial. Namely, the inclusion of a sitting congresswoman, Rashida Tlaib, and that would have to be under consideration and revisions would need to be made, and we would be in consultation about those revisions.
Why was that controversial? Because she's a member of Congress.
That was our question exactly. Why would a sitting member of Congress, the first Palestinian woman to sit in Congress, be controversial, and why wouldn't we be able to list her? And all that she was in the current lesson plan that has since been submitted as a public comment and is made available to the public, she was listed as an example of a significant figure to be studied, an Arab American significant figure. It would be hard to argue why the first sitting Palestinian American congresswoman should not be included on a list of significant figures for an Arab American lesson plan. However, what we understood is that the issue there was the fact that she is associated with supporting the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement against Israel. And for that reason, CDE would have to vet that lesson and scrutinize it and ensure that it did not offend others.
So the commission is going to advise the State Board of Education, which by law, as I said, must adopt the framework by March 31st.
So what we know moving forward is that based on directives from the IQC, the California Department of Education is now tasked with implementing those revisions within the latest draft. So incorporating any revisions that were adopted by the IQC, those revisions will be made to the public, open for 45 days of public comment, at which point those public comments will then be incorporated and deliberated by the CDE and then shared with the State Board of Education. At that point, the State Board of Education by March is required, according to the mandate, to adopt an ethnic studies model curriculum for the state of California to be shared across the state.
Remind us again about some of the deadlines coming up and what people can do.
Well, we're going to ask people to continue to monitor updates that we will share on our SaveArabAmericanStudies.org website. That is our coalition website. Again, that's SaveArabAmericanStudies.org. We are going to ask our committee members to continue to submit public comments in any public comment period. And we are also asking all of those who have relationships to decision makers and legislators in their local areas across the state of California to demand more of decision makers to stand with ethnic studies scholars and practitioners and young people and communities of color in this country today by demanding more of the IQC and CDE. It is a complete outrage what we've seen. It's an embarrassment. And we are really sad that this is what we're dealing with, especially at these times. But we're lucky that our students and families understand the urgency of these times. We trust the communities across the state also understand that. And we're eager to make changes. So we're hopeful that if people speak out and make demands of their local electeds and continue to engage in the public comment process, that we will make it clear that the mass opposition to this rolling back of ethnic studies and progressive politics in California is not only unwanted, but is unacceptable, and that we will continue to fight it, whether or not it's through the ethnic studies model curriculum, or we continue to fight on the local district to ensure that this ethnic studies model curriculum, if it is in fact an insult to the discipline, is not implemented in any district in the state of California.
Laura, the public comment period began on December 7th of last year, and it will end on January 21st. What can people do to register their concern about the process and the changes the commission made to the original curriculum?
So we've made it pretty easy for community members to chime in and take action on this issue. We have a one-click petition that if you sign it will be registered as public comment as well as go to local legislators across the state of California to encourage them to also take action. All of that can be found at SaveArabAmericanStudies.org. We also have templates and encourage organizations and associations to send in statements of support, and all that information is found on our website. There's multiple ways that you can register your concerns and also your support for ethnic studies, and we encourage everybody to take action before January 21st.
Laura Kiswani is the Executive Director of the Arab Resource and Organizing Center, AROC. To learn more about the California Studies curriculum for K through 12 students and how to support the integrity of ethnic studies in the biggest education system in the U.S., please visit araborganizing.org. The public comment period will end.
When your parents need your help, you're there. When your kids say something's wrong, you're there. When your friends have a rough day, you're there. Be there for yourself the way you're there for others, as it's normal for these uncertain times to bring out negative emotions or anxiety. If you're finding it difficult to carry out daily tasks, there are solutions. Visit quebec.ca/gettingbetter or call Info Social 811. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
Now more than ever, the simplest gestures are our best protection to fight the virus. That's why we need to continue following basic health measures, such as keeping a 2-meter distance from others, wearing a mask and washing our hands regularly. Avoid travel and non-essential trips. And if you develop symptoms, be sure to get tested promptly and follow self-isolation guidelines. See all of the measures in place at quebec.ca/coronavirus. Let's continue to protect ourselves. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.